It's a play with fantastic music. It isn't like the repertoire, the Bohems, the Butterflies, Traviatas that we do all the time. It's a powerful piece, not that the others aren't powerful, but it's about this sort of extraordinary character who alienates himself from absolutely everybody, and all these amazing characters that surround him in this horrible community of villagers who really hate him and despise him and are jealous, all the things that we might talk about in a minute. But it is an extraordinary piece, and it has such a power.
A lot of my friends who have never been to the opera before have heard me sing this role and thought, wow, I didn't realize this is what opera was all about. You know, they have this stereotype that it's all, you know, Viking helmets in a foreign language and people are just planted on stage. This is a very active production of Peter Grimes. And the characters are very realistic and people can relate to the characters themselves. I mean, they're characters that are present in our society today.
It's full of actors. That's the model. It's nearly always get good actors. You don't get the ordinary opera lot. The fact that we're singing it in English as well, it does bring out something in all of them, because they're all English speaking, and it has a resonance for everybody.
William Spaulding, your apprentice, died in accidental circumstances. But that's the kind of thing people have to remember.
But when the crowd sits upon his feet and dares to kiss 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 and dares to I must have help.
Then get a woman to help you look after him.
That's what I want, but not yet.
Why not?
Not till I stop people's mouths.
Stand down, clear the court, stand down.
Stand down, you say. You wash your hands. The peace goes on in people's minds. The charges that no court has made will be shouted at my head.
Peter Grimes is a wonderful character. He's misunderstood and an outcast. And I think what makes him an outcast is he marches to his own drummer. And oftentimes when people do that, society does not take that too lightly. And he's, as I said, misunderstood. I think he's a very well-read man, self-educated. When he comes in to the boar and sings this wonderful aria, Now the Great Bear in Pleiades, it shows the poetic side of Peter Grimes. So sometimes in portrayals of Peter Grimes, you don't see the softer side of Peter Grimes, and I think that I've incorporated that in my performance of Peter Grimes. So. I think the role's biggest challenge is to have that balance vocally of the lyricism and the more dramatic side of the part. I consider myself more of a method type of actor. And when I first, you know, put the emotion back into the opera, I was a little nervous at first, now I think I've gotten that balance of knowing when to give and when to keep, you know, rein it in a bit.
Somebody who just sees the good in everybody, and maybe that's the school teacher in her that wants to bring out what's wonderful in children, and I think there's a little bit of that in her, that somewhat misguided attempt to save him, bring out the good. And I think in the end she, you know, not only is left heartbroken, but feels very guilty that she misread specifically the escalation of his demise.
The boys,
my broidered anchor on the chest.
When Balstrode says, when horror breaks one heart, all hearts are broken. And when I first read that line, I thought that describes ultimately what, for me, is the great story of Ellen, that she realizes that the town is destroying him and at the same time destroying themselves, but they don't see it that way. She certainly sees it that way and feels the enormous loss.
All are broken.
Captain Bulstrode is a retired sea captain. He's possibly a little bit older than I am. I just turned 50. But I would say that in 1840, that was probably retirement age. he's sort of the voice of wisdom, the voice of sort of the calm, even keel in the piece. He really seems to appreciate fairness, and he's constantly trying to get the crowd to calm down because they really go crazy toward Peter Grimes and Ellen Orford. It turns into a real lynch mob, and he's trying to single-handedly oppose the mob psychology, which he's not very successful at doing.
What is it? Forget what slander can invent. What do you suppose? Grimes is a beast. Exercise.
Some characters in opera that I've done, like I've sung Amneris a lot, and Eboli, they have... they may be evil and appear that way, but they're multifaceted. They have a good side and a bad side, like most people. Mrs. Sedley is all evil. However, a lot of people, I think, when they think of a character like Mrs. Sedley, who's all evil, they think, oh, yes, okay, it's a caricature. You play it like a cardboard character. But she's multifaceted in her evil. In other words, in some scenes, she's smug, and some scenes, she's... just nasty to other people. She almost goes into a sexual frenzy when she's solving murder. She's an old lady, but it really turns her on to accuse other people of doing things. And she has a lot of different facets of her evil.
Have you my pills?
I'm smutty mouth.
Sleeping drowned.
The Lord of him is out of stock and being brought by Mr. Paddy Hobson's cart. He's back tonight.
Good Lord! Good Lord!
Just both in the pub, the ball, aunties we call it. It's quite safe.
I've never been in a pub in my life.
You'll come.
All right.
Tonight.
All right. My God, you'll come.
Oh, glory.
The carter's on a half an hour late.
He'll be later still. The road's on the blood.
I can't stay longer. I refuse.
You'll have to stay if you want your pills.
Please, come on, see me. I'm in trouble.
They're aunties, nieces, that's what they are, and better than you for kissing. Ah, I'm at home.
Well, Ned Keene, as is obvious, is the apothecary of the village. Pretty successful individual. And I don't think he is, he's not villainous, and he's certainly not soulless, but I think his primary motivation in just about everything he does in the opera is opportunistic and driven by trying to obtain a profit. He's very good at what he does, and I think part of the reason is that he's always looking for the angle that he can work, and I think that's why he is the one who's... goes against the crowd and decides to procure a new apprentice for Peter, even though the ruling has come down that Peter is to have no more boys.
Job for you.
It's always important for me to have a good rapport with the apprentice. And so I always come up and introduce myself and make sure that he knows that he's always in control of all the action. So when it appears like that Spike is being thrown from stage left to stage right, you know, or vice versa, or that, you know, I'm have my hands around his neck and something, he's always in control of all of that. I'm just really just going like this and going in Spike's direction. So it's wonderful to have the great fortune of having Spike in this production.
Come, apprentice, come!
Well, the big thing is he just actually grabs me, and I get to move around. It actually looks really realistic, but it's all me for that those little parts. And he throws me pretty gently. He just sort of does that, and then I have to go boom, boom, boom. People ask me if it's scary to be working with him. He's very loud, but it's fun doing stuff with someone of that high, just very professional. It's fun to be singing with a Metropolitan Opera person. I think music and opera will always sort of remain part of my life, but I don't know if it's going to necessarily be my life. I mean, I wouldn't be unhappy if I was Tony Griffey. I think it's very appealing, but I'm not quite sure yet.
We need a lot of fun from everybody with the shoo-shoo your little barnacles. All of you guys should think it's amusing and fun, not the widow. They have no humour and they're children
John is probably the most experienced stage director alive today. I mean, he's been with Covent Garden, where he started life. He sort of grew up virtually in the floorboards as a boy. And he did anything to be there. And he actually starred in this opera as the boy apprentice in 1949. He's worked with virtually every singer of the day of note, starting with Callas. And going on through virtually everybody you could name. And so his experience is second to none.
The door flies open, and guess who walks in? Mrs. Session. What's she doing here? We need to observe, particularly this table. You can just do a little bit. You haven't got to be really deep, but you do need to observe.
It's wonderfully acted by a remarkable cast. And the chorus is magnificent. I mean, they are part of a character in the opera. The chorus is a malevolent group of 60 people screaming for vengeance about which they don't understand.
Oh!
the huge problem of Grimes is the actual construction, the putting it together. And I have had a marvellous backup. I have a marvellous assistant, Keturah, who's actually put all the paperwork together so that all of the entrances and all the staircases and everywhere they go has been organised for me. I haven't had to spend hours and hours and hours of time on that, which we haven't had, because we haven't actually had any time whatsoever to do this. It's the shortest rehearsal period that I've ever, ever had for Peter Grimes. And that's the way of the world now. I mean, we cannot afford longer. We know that. All our rehearsal periods have to be short.
Guys that have sleds or litters, if you can make sure that all of the props, you can fold up those sails as if they're fixed and put them on the litter so that when the supers come out, it's a very fast removal for them, that they can just pick those up and go.
And the incredibly brilliant stage management here have just got it all sorted. In this strange room, we put the whole opera together in 10 days. I have to organise that in the first instance, and I have to decide absolutely. I need to know where everybody's coming from, what they're doing, what they're carrying, if it's a net, if it's an oar, if it's a piece of a boat. Or that's all a huge process that takes me a great deal of time when I'm putting an opera together. I mean, it's as time-consuming doing Peter Grimes in that way as it is learning a Mozart opera by heart. Because as directors, we have to know it by heart. We have to learn everybody's lines, and that's hours of work.
Nice little boy, tell me, nice sweet thing, what was such as you?
Yeah. Let's go, you ready? Let them warm up, they've been half
Britten's often linked his scenes, if he has more than one scene in an opera, in an act, he would probably link them with an interlude, simply so that the flow of the music continued, despite the fact there was a scene change. And there are two in the first act, both covering scene changes. One, the dawn interlude and the sea, after the prologue, the trial scene. Very descriptive writing. You can simply, the first interlude, you can hear the sea and the seagulls. You just shut your eyes and you can hear the waves going, the massive power of the sea, which is evoked by the brass chords and then the high violin tune, high violins and flute, sort of give the idea of seagulls. It's all there, and you can't miss the storm. Terrific racket. Yes. Blows you out, blows you away.
The great old Joe. It's funny because it's a ingeniously written piece of ensemble. But it is so hard.
That's literally a sort of joyful round, as it were. But it's been put into a 7/4 metre, which just makes it slightly more awkward for everybody. But it's very catchy nonetheless. But it becomes extremely difficult to maintain, particularly when all the voices are going, and do something different. And in the end, I know Britten used to say he wished he'd never written it, caused so much trouble.
As soon as you start to feel relaxed at all, you're going to fall in a little crevice and have to get yourself extracted again. You know, you never get to relax with it.
But it's the most wonderful, beautiful quartet at the end of Act 2, Scene 1, where suddenly it becomes almost Straussian. That's worth hearing many times.